I mean, the West is largely absent from Libya, having used that as a laboratory to prove that it can conduct a military strike and create a good outcome. In fact, the opposite is demonstrated. The West is entirely absent. And as you know, the American embassy is no longer in Libya. The American embassy to Libya is based in Malta. And there's no emphasis from the West to try to once again bring parties together. It is a very dangerous situation, which is why the UN envoy has repeatedly said over the course of several months that we are near total chaos inside Libya. It's a real scandal, and I wish there was more reporting, more care about what's happening to a country that was destroyed by a war prosecuted by NATO.
And finally, the U.S. drone strikes in Yemen.
Well, you know, it's clear to people who observe Yemen that until the U.S. drone strikes, until the U.S. invasion of Iraq, al-Qaeda had been largely vanquished in Yemen. And it was because of Abdullah Saleh, his own vendetta against the Zaydi people. Well, to put it like this, the drone strikes don't seem to be having the kind of impact that the government says they have. They seem to be having the opposite impact. It's too bad that there's been no reassessment of the strategy of assassinating people and meanwhile killing
very large number of civilians. Vijay Prashad, we thank you for being with us, Professor of International Studies at Trinity College. I'm Mimi Goodman with Aaron Mattei.
And you are tuned in to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, also heard on the web at www.kboo.fm. The time is 5 o'clock. Straight up, stay tuned for the KBOO Tuesday Evening News coming up after this message.
Help KBOO Radio promote our upcoming membership drive, which begins on February 4th. Just go to the KBOO website, kboo.fm, and click on the blue banner to help us thunderclap our drive on social media. And be sure to tune in from February 4th to 14th for lots of special programs and gifts, including the first ever Bluegrass Marathon.
Magenta Rex, navigating the landscape of our sordid human history with care and compassion. You can find it online at kboo.fm/content/thespec, or by going to the KBOO homepage, clicking on programs, and scrolling all the way down to the Speciesism podcast. Yeah.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the City of Portland is reconsidering participation in the JTTF.
A Gresham baker who refused to make a cake for a same-sex wedding faces a possible fine.
And the administration announces minor changes to the NSA's surveillance program.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, February 3rd, 2015. I'm Nicole Weinstock.
And I'm Doug McVeigh. The City of Portland will be reconsidering its position on the Federal Joint Terrorism Task Force this Thursday and may vote as early as next week. The city initially joined the task force in 1997, formalizing its involvement in 2000, but pulled out of the program in 2005. The City of Portland is the only place that has an FBI field office and does not participate in the JTTF. The JTTF is an interagency coordination center tasked with surveillance, electronic monitoring, and interrogation of suspects. The task force was created by the federal government with the stated aim of addressing terrorism, wire fraud, and identity theft. In 2013, the ACLU criticized a lack of transparency in the reports released by the city about the way the city had been working with the JTTF. Under a current proposal by Mayor Hales, If Portland rejoins the task force, the city may no longer issue any report detailing its involvement, which would provide even less transparency. The mayor's spokesman says he wants the city to be all in or all out of the task force and is willing to hear arguments from both sides. The ACLU of Oregon says the FBI operates under its own set of rules that don't match the values of the people of Portland.
In January 2013, Melissa Klein of Sweet Cakes by Melissa in Gresham refused to sell a wedding cake to a same-sex couple. An investigation ensued, during which time Klein relocated her business to her home. Now, 2 years later, recent events suggest that the Christian bakery owner may have to pay up to $150,000 in damages for discrimination. Here's KBOO's Nicole Weinstock with more. This is Charlie Burr, the Communications Director at the Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industry. Welcome, Charlie.
Thanks for having me on.
What did the Bureau announce on Monday with regards to Sweet Cakes Bakery?
Well, an administrative law judge with our agency ruled that a Gresham bakery unlawfully discriminated against a same-sex couple when it denied them full and equal access to a public place, a place of public accommodations.
From a legal standpoint, what makes the Sweet Cakes case one of decided discrimination?
Well, under Oregon law, no one can be denied service based on their sexual orientation or gender identity. The law provides an exception for religious organizations and schools, but doesn't allow a private business to discriminate based on orientation, just like they can't deny based on race, sex, age, disability, or religion.
What kind of penalties might Sweet Cakes face in response to the Bureau's conclusion?
Well, the next step in the process is for our agency to have a hearing next month to determine what kind of damages will be assessed for unlawful discrimination. The agency and prosecutors within the agency are looking at potential damages of up to $75,000 per person, but that hasn't been determined. That's what the hearing next month will be all about.
Mm-hmm. Is there any potential for backlash or counter lawsuits?
After our process is finished and Commissioner Bradavakian issues a final order, the respondents, the owners of the bakery, can file with the Court of Appeals and try to appeal the decision. But from our standpoint, we conducted a thorough investigation. We found substantial evidence of wrongdoing. And, of course, we have a duty to enforce this and other civil rights laws.
And finally, how do you think this particular case will influence the larger legal landscape of discrimination and the LGBTQ community?
We think it's important for any Oregonian, if he or she believes that they're being unlawfully discriminated against at work or when seeking a place to live or going about their daily lives, that they know that they have rights, and our agency is committed to strong enforcement of the Oregon Equality Act and other civil rights protections. Bradavakian, the Commissioner of Labor and Industries, served as a legislator and fought for this act when he was in Salem. He actually carried the Oregon Equality Act of 2007 on the floor prior to its passage. And it's an important protection, but it's equally important that we have strong enforcement of the act.
Thank you so much for taking the time, Charlie.
Thanks for having me on.
This is Nicole Weinstock with KBOO Evening News.
A new website has emerged in response to growing concerns about the changing face of Portland. The Portland Chronicle, an anonymously staffed website providing news on land use and development, is the new go-to for Rose City citizens wanting up-to-date information on local demolitions. A fairly neutral site, the Portland Chronicle typically provides the facts on demolition applications such as applicant names, the ages of houses to be demolished, and sale price history. To see what's going on in your neighborhood, visit www.portlandchronicle.com.
The Oregon legislature began its session yesterday in Salem and will likely continue through June. At a legislative town hall meeting this weekend at Portland Community College, several Oregon state legislators heard from local residents and outlined their priorities for the legislative session. Tina Kotek, the Speaker of the House, shared her views about the state budget and other priorities.
There are some very specific things we need to do around revenue this coming session. One of them is to look at the tax credits that we have. We set in place a few years ago that every tax credit on the books would get a review every 6 years. And that's a range of things. So the ones that are up this year for review in the tax credit world are ones that we all like a lot. The working family child care credit, the earned income tax credit are the two biggest ones. And to renew them, it would cost about $70 million. So we have to figure out how to pay for those first. So that is a priority. We might look at other tax expenditures, tax credits on the books, and maybe shave those a little to help pay for those. So there'll be some work done to pay for the tax credits we like and maybe take some money from other places. The other issue that's going to be addressed is resolving the Conway decision. There was a decision a couple years ago by the courts, there was a company called Conway, who challenged how we had set the corporate minimum tax here in the state. Remember passing as voters the corporate minimum tax, saying at some level every corporation is going to pay a minimum tax. Well, Conway said, I have all these tax credits that reduces my liability, so I don't have a corporate minimum anymore. That's not what voters intended, at least that's what I think. So we'll be looking at the Conway decision and adjusting that, and that could raise some revenue for the state that we could put into essential services. So those are the types of things we're looking at right now. There will certainly be proposals around different ways to adjust the tax structure. It's a little hard for me to see how much traction they will have, but what you will see in the budget that we will be working on is, so even though I think we're going to have a good budget coming out of this session, it is not the budget that we as Oregonians want to make the game-changing investments we need in public education, all the way from early childhood to higher ed. It's not the budget that we know would help us do more preventive work in the state. So I fully expect by next year that we'll be having a conversation about taxes, potentially on the ballot in 2016, because we really do have to have an honest conversation in the state about what do we care about and are we willing to pay for it so we can have the state we want.
But so thank you for your support for House Bill 2564, which would lift the statewide ban on inclusionary zoning. How do you imagine North and Northeast Portland could benefit from a strong inclusionary housing program once the ban is lifted?
Well, the good thing is I believe the mayor in his State of the City address yesterday said he will support inclusionary zoning as an option for Portland, which is the first step. So I think we should thank the mayor. Because even if we say local communities go use this, local communities have to go use it. So it's helpful for our city leaders to know that that's a priority for you. And it is on the City of Portland's legislative agenda. So good job on the city's part. You know, I don't know, in North and Northeast Portland, it does provide the opportunity for new development to have some affordable housing set-asides similar to what we're doing with the urban renewal areas. The only place we can currently do it is urban renewal money can be, you know, the 30% affordable housing target that we have here in the city. I think it depends on what development in North and Northeast Portland's going in. Certainly we have a lot on the max lines. I do think it's important. I think it might have more impact in other parts of the city, to be honest. One of the things that I'm worried about and contemplating how the state could be helpful in addition to inclusionary zoning is what's happening in our community. Starter homes that have been in the neighborhood for a long time are being torn down, and they're being replaced by very, very large houses that are very expensive. And so not only are we losing, thank you, we're losing housing stock for like first-time home buyers, because those aren't first-time home buyer homes. I look at how much they are in my street, and I'm like, I'm never going to pay for those. And then we're pushing people out. So we really have to look a little harder at our anti-gentrification efforts here. I think some of that... There are some very specific things we need to do around revenue this coming session. One of them.
That was Tina Kotek, the Speaker of the Oregon House, sharing her priorities for the legislative session that started this week.
Oregon will soon have a new cash crop. The State Agriculture Department is accepting applications from people interested in growing or processing hemp. A one-year hemp growing or processing license costs $1,500. There is also a state license to become a hemp seed grower, which also costs $1,500 per year. The legislature set up Oregon's pilot hemp program in 2009. The department's administrative rules regarding hemp production only went into effect on Monday. It took the state this long because hemp production is still against federal law. Oregon and other states interested in hemp production got some relief in last year's federal budget. The appropriations bill contained a provision preventing the Department of Justice and the DEA from interfering with most state-authorized hemp production programs. The new budget from the Obama administration, on the other hand, calls for an end to that restriction. Advocates hope that the current Congress will pass a law to fully legalize hemp as an agricultural crop. More information on Oregon's hemp program, as well as application forms, are available through the Department of Agriculture website at oregon.gov/ODA.
Dogs have long been used to sniff out things like drugs and explosives due to their great sense of smell. But the current drug-sniffing dogs may be on their way out in Oregon, considering the new state marijuana laws that take effect in July. The problem is that drug-sniffing dogs are trained to detect all kinds of drugs, not just marijuana. In other words, if a dog finds legal marijuana, it could trigger an illegal search. Springfield officer Darren Kendrick says that this is a conversation every agency with a drug detection dog is having or has had for several months now, and how it's being addressed varies from agency to agency. Police work is like the ocean. We have to go with the flow and always be able to adapt to changing technologies and laws to help the community.
Physicians and other healthcare providers at Veterans Affairs hospitals could soon be allowed to recommend medical marijuana to their patients. Earlier today, Oregon Congressman Earl Blumenauer, along with a bus act. Currently, VA doctors are prohibited from issuing recommendations or signing other state forms to authorize their patients to use marijuana as medicine. There's a great deal of research showing that marijuana can be useful for treating symptoms of post-traumatic stress. The VA estimates that at least 10 to 20% of veterans of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars suffer from PTS in any given year. Marijuana is also a useful therapy for some chronic pain conditions. Unlike with opiates, marijuana overdoses are never fatal. If enacted, the law would only apply in states which have legalized medical marijuana.
Mexican cartels are increasing their stake in the opium market, according to a new report by the Associated Press. The report claims that federal authorities are cracking down on prescription drugs, leading many addicts to turn to heroin as a cheap fix to their need for opiates. Though not enough statistical evidence is available yet, it is believed widely that marijuana legalization has hampered the drug trade coming from Mexico, and the shift to opium production is a result of that trend. Currently, a farmer in Mexico can make about $900 for 1 kilo of opium, while the current going price for marijuana has dropped to $17 per kilo. Extreme poverty has led some farmers to grow opium for the cartels. The opium is then moved from the farms to various hubs. Eventually, much of the processed heroin that results comes into the United States, where it is finding its way into every class and culture. Heroin overdoses in the city of Portland, for example, numbered just 20 in the year 2000. But now, 15 years later, that number is over 100 per year. Starting this year, Portlanders now have access to a new drug called Narcan, which can reverse the effects of heroin overdoses.
And now we turn to the weekly commentary from Paul Cienfuegos for Community Rights and Dismantling Corporate Rule, produced weekly for the Tuesday Evening News.
Greetings, you're listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. In the fall of 2009, a very unusual ballot initiative was voted on by the people of Spokane, Washington. It was a locally enforceable community bill of rights that, if approved, would have given the local residents, for the first time in the history of the city, a prohibition on various kinds of corporate developments that a specific neighborhood was opposed to, a whole variety of new legal protections for working people, and newly defined rights of nature for the Spokane River and aquifer. And to top it all off, the initiative stated that if a corporate constitutional so-called right clashed with any of these newly enshrined rights for people and nature, that that corporate right would be nullified within the boundaries of the city. Nothing like this had ever been put on a ballot before anywhere in the United States, so the campaign did not exactly expect to win the vote. Their goal was indeed much bolder, to begin to change the conversation among Spokane residents about who we are as citizens and what is our proper relationship with the corporate institutions that have come to wield so much political, social, economic, and most importantly, legal power over we the people. In November of 2009, the initiative garnered about 24% of the vote, which the campaign chose to see as a victory because the initiative started a whole new kind of public conversation. Fast forward 2 years, and the campaign put a similar ballot initiative forward on the November 2011 ballot. And this time, although they were massively outspent by their mostly corporate opponents, they garnered more than 49% of the vote, which was way more votes than the campaign itself had expected. Again, they called this a win because their larger goal was not a single ballot initiative, but the larger and more complex work of culture shift to help the citizens of Spokane to stand up together and insist that corporations must be subordinate to we the people if we are to honestly claim that we live in a democratic republic. As you can well imagine, the campaign decided to run the ballot initiative again in November of 2013, but this time the opposition had been scared enough to mobilize not just with money, but with a preemptive lawsuit intended to block the initiative from even being placed on the ballot for voters to decide. The campaign was sued by a large number of business associations and corporations, as well as by a number of Spokane's elected leaders, a veritable who's who of the small elite group of people who really run the city, and who certainly do not appreciate anyone who would dare challenge the political and legal power that they wield behind the scenes. The judge who heard the case pulled the initiative off the ballot, and in response, the campaign countersued, claiming that the rights of the voters had been violated. Finally, this past Friday, January 29th, the state appellate court reversed the lower court's decision, which means the initiative will now appear on either the April or November ballot, unless the Spokane city government appeals the court's decision. The court's 21-page ruling was multifaceted, and I don't have the time here to properly review it, other than to share with you a brief excerpt, where the court shares text from another case in 2005 called Coppernol v. Reed, and I quote, "Pre-election review of initiative measures is highly disfavored. The fundamental reason is that the right of initiative is nearly as old as our Constitution itself, deeply ingrained in our state's history and widely revered as a powerful check and balance on the other branches of government. Given the preeminence of the initiative right, pre-election challenges to the substantive validity of initiatives are particularly disallowed. Such review, if engaged in, would involve the court in rendering advisory opinions, would violate ripeness requirements, would undermine the policy of avoiding unnecessary constitutional questions, and would constitute unwarranted judicial meddling within the legislative process. Further, substantive pre-election review could unduly infringe on the citizens' right to freely express their views to their elected representatives. That the law enacted by an initiative might be unconstitutional does not mean that it is beyond the power of the state to enact. Therefore, a claim that an initiative would be unconstitutional if enacted is not subject to pre-election review." Unquote. It is truly wonderful that the courts ruled on the side of we the people in this specific case, but that is unfortunately quite rare, as many listeners already know. Our larger work, as the citizenry of these United States, is to reimagine our society as one where we the people don't have to spend tens of thousands of dollars and endless hours every time the powers that be wish to challenge our authority to govern ourselves. This would require paying attention to the actual structures of law, the scaffolding itself that makes self-governance so difficult to achieve. Next week, instead of my usual commentary, I will share more details about our big win in court, and will be interviewing the attorney who argued in favor of the right of the people to vote on this nationally groundbreaking Spokane Community Bill of Rights. Don't miss it. You can find out more at envisionspokane.org. You've been listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. You can hear future commentaries every Tuesday on the KBOO Evening News and a growing number of other radio stations. I welcome your feedback. You can subscribe to my weekly podcast via iTunes or at communityrightspdx.org. You can follow me on Twitter at CienfuegosPaul. You can sign up for my newsletter at paulcienfuegos.com. Thanks for listening, and remember, we are the people we've been waiting for.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO's in-depth coverage on the new Keystone Pipeline EPA report, followed by Out Loud at 6. Alexis Page from CAP will join us and talk about upcoming health insurance enrollment fair, as well as a new development in local trans healthcare. Also, Amy Hertzfeld of Basic Rights Oregon will tell us about BRO's strategic planning process, what's next for BRO, and an upcoming open house at BRO's offices. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather, a 30% chance of rain, mainly after 10 p.m. with patchy fog and a low around 44. Tomorrow, a 40% chance of rain, mainly before 10 a.m. and more patchy fog. Otherwise, mostly cloudy with a high near 56. On this day in 1959, the music died. Rock and roll singers Buddy Holly, Richie Valens, and J.P. Richardson, the Big Bopper, died in a plane crash today along with the pilot when their chartered plane went down near Mason City, Iowa. The quote of the day is from Howard Zinn. Historically, the most terrible things, war, genocide, and slavery, have resulted not from disobedience, but from obedience.
It's 5:26. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
It's always interesting to see Congress in action, though interesting can also be appalling. For example, what a sight it is to watch Republican leaders as they gleefully try to repeal Obamacare, the law extending health care coverage to all Americans. As they vote one by one to kill it, their mantra is no to big government health care. What you can't see, however, is them later slipping down the hallways of the Capitol to a little-known exclusive medical office that gives them free health care, paid for by the same big government they were just ranting about. You might think that such raw hypocrisy would cause them to feel at least a twinge of moral discomfort, but apparently they've been immunized to prevent such outbreaks of morality. A good illustration of the congressional mindset is presently making the rounds on the internet. Called The Haircut, it tells the story of a barber who cut the hair of a florist, but refused to take payment from the flower peddler. "I'm doing community service this week," he explained. The next morning, when the barber went to his shop, he found a thank you note and a dozen roses at his door. His next customer was a police officer needing a trim. Again, the barber declined any payment. The next morning, he found a thank you note and a dozen donuts waiting for him, a gift from the grateful cop. Then, lo and behold, a congressman came in for a haircut. When he tried to pay, the barber once more waved off the money, repeating his commitment to community service. The lawmaker was delighted by this generous gesture. And sure enough, when the barber went to his shop the next morning, he was greeted by another surprise. A dozen Congress critters lined up waiting for a free haircut. This is Jim Hightower saying, see, it's just a matter of one's moral makeup. Assuming, of course, that you have a moral makeup. What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The Obama administration announced today that it is making minor changes in the National Security Agency's rules on collection of surveillance data. Privacy rights advocates, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, called the changes as tepid and say that they fail in a number of ways. KABU reporter Doug McVeigh spoke with the EFF's activism director, Rainey Reitman, to find out more.
Rainey, could you tell us what actually was announced today?
Well, I don't think people should get their hopes up, frankly. Obama has been saying for a year that he was going to make some pretty big changes to NSA surveillance. And what he announced today was a little bit more modest than what many of us would have hoped for. He is going to stop the... basically, he's going to continue bulk collecting digital communications of people overseas, and occasionally sweeping up Americans' communications in the process. But when they do get Americans' communications, they are going to swiftly discard that information rather than hanging on to it in a big database. And then if they pull in the information of people outside the United States who are not American citizens in that process, but those people are innocent and they haven't done anything wrong and they're not connected to a crime, then the administration has promised to get rid of that information as well, but only after 5 years.
All right. Now, and that's it. Wow.
Well, there were a couple of other very small changes. Made a small tweak to national security letters. National security letters are these, we would argue, unconstitutional orders that the FBI can give to service providers and have them turn over information on their users without ever being able to talk about it. And he made a slight change there, but it wasn't really the kind of overhaul that we would have liked. He put a three-year limit on the gag rather than saying that there should be no gag unless a judge signs off on it. So pretty moderate reforms, if you would call it that.
What were you hoping that the president might do?
Well, a couple of things. I think what most people should remember when they think about this issue is that Obama doesn't have to wait for Congress to act. Obama actually has the authority to end mass surveillance, so the type of surveillance where you're sweeping up hundreds of millions of people's communications, when they use technology every day. So Obama actually could issue an executive order that ended mass surveillance. He could certainly issue an executive order recognizing the privacy rights of people outside the United States in similar ways to how we recognize them within the United States. So I'd say those two things would have been powerful steps for the president to take. And in addition, it would be good if he worked to overhaul the national security letter system so that we didn't have service providers gagged without a judge actually saying that they needed to be gagged. So sort of a return to due process and judicial authority in that sense. Those are things which would have been powerful. And certainly so much of what we've learned in the last year has been the result of leaks provided by whistleblowers who risked a great amount to make this information public. So I think it would be much better if the president could make a commitment to being more transparent about the types of surveillance that we're engaged in that affect everyday people so that we can have a really informed public debate about the issue. So more transparency and perhaps an investigation into how these types of surveillance abuses happened as well would have been welcome.
Well, disappointing. Now, the so-called Patriot Act expires on June 1st. What does that mean?
So when Congress first adopted the Patriot Act, it was done very quickly in the months right after 9/11. And there were certain sections of the Patriot Act that were extremely controversial. And those, three of those sections are up for renewal in June. And one of the sections in particular, called Section 215 of the Patriot Act, is a section of law which the government claims gives it the right to engage in bulk collection of everyone's telephone records. This is the famous Verizon order that Edward Snowden leaked last year. And the if this section of law were to expire, as it's set to in June, it would put the government on very rocky legal ground to continue to engage in the surveillance of people's telephone records. So this is kind of spurring a conversation in Congress about whether or not to enact strong NSA reform, because if they don't pass anything, it means that that section of law will expire.
Now, and people want to find out more, if people want to, about this and about the work you're doing, where should they go?
Well, we have a website. It's EFF.org for the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And then we have a newsletter that we put out about every other week called Effector. And so people can sign up for the newsletter on our website.
Thank you so much.
Have a great day.
You too. This is Doug McVeigh with KBOO News. And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at LaborRadio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The United Steelworkers say that the oil refinery strike at 9 facilities in Texas, California, and Kentucky is about safe staffing levels, and wages are not the primary focus. Tom Conway is a vice president with USW International.
This strike is about safe staffing levels inside the refineries and staffing levels of our maintenance workforces, and having safe and reliable and efficient staffing in the refineries. And the situation that exists today just has become unacceptable. We have people who are working 12, 14, 16, 18 continuous days without a day off on 12-hour shifts, and people are stressed with an amazing amount of overtime and fatigue and sleep deprivation. It's dangerous. It's a dangerous way to run an operation like a fuel refinery.
Conway says the USW didn't want the strike and is ready to immediately return to the bargaining table.
We didn't seek this strike. We're not looking for it, but we need problems solved, and just an intransigent attitude from them isn't going to get us there. It's not going to solve the problem. So hopefully they look at these in a genuine way and come back and are willing to sit with us and have an honest discussion about how do we make sure we have a well-trained, adequate workforce. They don't seem to us to be difficult discussions that a management should be so unwilling to have with its workforce.
The United Steelworkers represent workers at 65 U.S. oil refineries that produce about 64% of the country's refined oil. The USW was in negotiations with Shell Oil as part of a national pattern bargaining process when Shell walked away from the labor talks, triggering the strike. U.S. Secretary of Labor Thomas Perez says the Bureau of Labor Statistics 2014 Union Membership Report underscores the value of labor unions for workers. Perez says the report confirms what we've always known, that belonging to a union makes a powerful difference in people's lives, providing greater economic security and helping them punch their ticket to the middle class, according to Perez. The report says non-union workers earn just 79% of what union workers make, a difference of about $10,000 a year for union members. The report also showed that for women, being in a union means that salaries are closer to their male counterparts than those of non-union women. Perez says unions and the right to collectively bargain are more vital now than ever. Perez says when unions are strong, working families thrive and wages rise with productivity. But when union density declines, there's downward pressure on wages.
Brought to you by the IBEW, 750,000 men and women powering the way for an American comeback. Information on how to become an International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Power Professional is online at ibew.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The British Parliament has approved the development of genetically engineered humans using the DNA of three people. The bill is passed through the House of Commons, but must still be approved by the House of Lords before it is made law. If approved, it will allow British scientists to combine the DNA of three people, creating the first genetically modified human. The process would involve removing the nucleus DNA from the egg of a prospective mother and inserting it into a donor egg. The resulting embryo would contain less than 1% of the DNA from the original egg. British law currently forbids any such modification, and critics say approving the techniques could lead to the creation of, quote, designer babies, unquote. Women with mitochondrial defects are trying to get the method approved in order to prevent them from passing on genetic defects. The technique is different from the one used to engineer seeds, in which individual genes are selected and spliced to create new varieties. But bioethicists and other critics warn that this development in Britain could be the first step in a slippery slope toward that level of genetic modification of human embryos.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Tuesday, February 3rd, 2015. Eight Palestinians killed in a traffic accident in Israel. Meanwhile, Israeli Navy attacked Palestinian fishermen in Gaza. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. At least eight Palestinians, all women, have been killed and dozens of others injured in a bus crash occurring in southern Israel, according to media sources. Preliminary reports said that the bus carrying Palestinian passengers, mostly of whom were women, from the Negev village of Hora, collided with a truck and a tractor at a highway in the Negev region. Elsewhere, Israeli settlers on Tuesday morning bulldozed over 50 dunams of Palestinian-owned lands in the village of Iskaka near the Za'atara checkpoint in Salfit Governorate, Central West Bank. Local sources announced that Israel has been on a roll, bulldozing more than 11 areas in Salfit district. In other news, Israeli soldiers kidnapped on Tuesday at least 10 Palestinians in different parts of the occupied West Bank after the army invaded various communities, broke into dozens of homes and searched them, causing property damage. Local sources reported home searches and kidnappings in the cities of Hebron and Bethlehem, southern West Bank, East Jerusalem and Nablus in the north. In Gaza, Israeli Navy ships opened fire on Tuesday at dawn on a number of Palestinian fishing boats in Gaza territorial waters in Rafah in the southern part of the coastal region. Local sources said that the Israeli Navy fired heavy rounds of live ammunition towards the boats, forcing the fishers to sail much closer to the shore, fearing for their lives. It added that the Navy also fired bursts of live rounds close to the shore before medics and rescue teams rushed to the scene to aid the fishers. No injuries were reported. Palestinian fishers and their boats are subjected to daily Israeli assaults in Gaza waters, close to shore and even while docked at the shore.
And now, from death row, Mumia Abu-Jamal remembers Billie Holiday.
In celebration of African Heritage Month, for Profiles in Excellence, we honor Billie Holiday was a consummate jazz singer, whose work continues to inspire and influence even after the passing of 50 years. What made her a legendary musical figure wasn't the power of her voice, nor its versatility. There were many women who far exceeded her on that score. What made her distinctive was both the honest, vulnerable tone of her sound, as well as the power of her material. Her classic, Strange Fruit, became an anthem against racist lynchings and discrimination. She played with melody, experimented with sound, and counted among her fans Malcolm X, who saw her live. Born Eleonora Fagan in Philadelphia, according to historian Charles Bloxon, she took the name Holiday from her father, Clarence. Despite her enormous talent, her life was marked by tragedy. She suffered from abuse and from heroin use, but as she might croon, ain't nobody's business if I do. For Hard Knock Radio and Prison Radio, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Joe Aaron, Nicole Weinstock, Doug McVeigh, and Jim Thompson. Our engineer is Sequoina Wright. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News.
Coming up tomorrow on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With journalists Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Wednesday Talk Radio, host Paul Roland speaks with activists from around the region about their efforts to shut down the fossil fuel industry's attempt to transform the West Coast of the U.S. and Canada into a massive export colony for the global economy. At 9, on Political Perspectives, Scott Horton, author of Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Warfare, talks about how government secrecy has ensured that decisions about war and peace are made not by the citizenry, but by the autonomous, self-directing, and unaccountable national security elites. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, the Bike Show brings you news and views of cycling in Portland and beyond. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. Tomorrow, our winter membership drive begins. Tune in for special programs, contests, and gifts.
I'm Doug McVeigh.
And I'm Nicole Weinstock.
Stay tuned for News in Depth.